Welcome, everyone. Good, big class tonight. So we are still in Module 6. This is Class 9. It will be the last in our series of teachings on Lojong, which is mind training. So tonight we'll be working with the last two points, point 6 and point 7, which is really a lot of the slogans, but we've covered the main points in the beginning. So we're not spending as much time on these, but I think that's okay because we can revisit Lojong teachings again. And the thing with Buddhist teachings, it's like going around a mountain. You kind of go around the mountain and you see one view, and then you go around again and you're at a little higher place. You've got more experience and more understanding, and you go around again and you're closer to the top, so you have a vaster view. So the Buddhist teachings are like that. We can keep revisiting the same teachings, and you'll notice all of a sudden you read something in the book and you go, wow, it pops out at you. So it never hurts to go back. And in fact, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talked about having to comb our hair. So we keep combing our hair, which means that comb goes back to the roots every time that you pass it through your hair. So I think that's a great image, and it actually informed my idea of how to lead this class tonight. So what I'd like to do first is basically zoom out and look at where we've been. People have been joining us along the way, and sometimes it may be hard to sort of step in when other people have had a little bit of a different background. So I'd like to zoom out and kind of go back a little bit, and then after that I want the class to be very open, and people may have brought slogans that they want to share or talk about or have questions about. So we'll kind of just open it up to this the last two main points. So if we zoom out and look at where we've been, starting with this past fall. And of course, people know things are online, but I know you may not always get a chance to look at the older teachings, the earlier teachings. So that module, the module 4, the beginning in September, that was September 2014, was called The Foundation of Buddhist Studies. And we really looked at why we study all together and the importance of study and practice, that they really go together. So that if you just practice without any study, you don't really have a vision of where you're going. You may not have a sense of how the teachings build and how the practice progresses. So the study aspect actually informs the practice, and the practice informs the study. You could just approach Buddhism from a very analytical point of view, and certainly many scholars have done that. But in fact, there's no way you can really understand these teachings without practice. And I know we've said that many times. So the practice actually enables us to bring the teachings alive within us and make whatever we learn really come alive. So together, study and practice is really important. So the first module in that fall series, module 4, was called focused on the Four Noble Truths. So as we said, these were the first teachings of the Buddha after he had attained enlightenment, and he encountered his buddies, you could say, who saw him and said, hey man, what's up? And they were stunned by his brilliance, and they realized he had attained something that they'd been looking for. They were all doing ascetic practices together, so they were pretty amazed. And so those were the first teachings, and those teachings were about suffering, and about the cessation of suffering. So that's where we started in the fall with those foundational teachings. And then we actually are zooming in more and more. So you could say we covered the ground of, you could say preliminary ground of suffering and the causes of suffering and how to get out of it, basically. So then the next teaching in January, we taught on working with emotions. And so we are zooming in just a little bit more. And if you remember, we talked about the reason we started working with emotions. And that's because the way we could start to unravel this cause of suffering was understanding the two veils. So veils is something like if you have cataracts, you know, your vision would be foggy. It's that sense of things being kind of covered over. And it's also called the two obscurations. So we talked about there being two veils. One is the knowledge veil, which is understanding non-self, which we keep mentioning that word. And the other is the klesha veil, or the veil of disturbing emotions. So the reason we start with disturbing emotions, it's definitely more tangible to us, and it seems a little easier way to go into understanding, because when we experience emotions, there's often, I mean, there are many different ways of experiencing emotions, but they can be hot and very vivid for us. So if we can learn how to work with that energy and understand how we cling to our view and our concepts and shut down around different things that come to us, then we can actually find a little breath of fresh air, you could say. So we worked with teachings by Dzogchen Panlop Rinpoche. This was also the same book we used in the fall, the PDF. And what he spoke to us about, or what he presented, was a way of working with emotions. And that was the three steps of working with mindful gap, which is sense of a pause, that we can actually take a moment when something arises. We can take a moment, just a gap, if we're able to hold our seat long enough. And the second step was clear seeing, or seeing clearly what's going on. Because we've been able to actually hold the space just maybe a fraction of a second and maybe a little longer, we can actually see more clearly what's developing in front of us. And then there's a process of, you could say, letting go of reacting from a fixation around me. And Michael Levin talked a lot about the storyline, and Pema actually mentions that in her book too. So the storyline is really holding on to something very solid about whatever that situation is, our belief systems, our concepts, our way of working with whatever is coming up. And maybe we just are in this track and we just keep going down the same route and we get the same results every time, because we're not changing what we're doing, but we're going down the same pathway. So the practice is one of actually starting to examine that, and you could say unraveling this fixation, or holding on so tightly to self that we can't actually interrupt this habitual pattern, these habitual patterns that we follow. So that was module 5, working with emotions. And of course, you know, there's a lot more to go on that one. So that's why then we moved into Lojong. So Lojong, as you know, Lo means mind and Jong means training. So this module, module 6, is called Lojong, Cultivating Compassion. And these teachings, what I love so much about these teachings, well, I hate them and I love them. They're hard, and I don't like to be reminded of all the things I don't do. But anyway, they're ancient teachings from the 11th century. And I think, wow, these people worked exactly with, you know, it's no different today. People are people. And they went way back then. They were blaming other people, and they were acting with a twist, and they were doing all these things that we do all the time. And these are teachings, okay, way back then, you know, no cell phones, but, you know, they were communicating in their own way. So they really apply just as much to us today. And I think when you really work with the Lojong teachings, you really see that. And so the main point here in working with Lojong is that we start to touch our deep-seated feelings about, I like this and I don't like that. I want this and I don't want that. So this whole pushing away what we don't want, grabbing onto what we want, and this constant process of pushing and pulling. It's really, the slogans are really about reversing those patterns. And you can see in Tonglin practice how that works. I mean, it's so vivid that you literally draw in on the breath what you don't want, or pain, or difficulty, or someone else's pain or difficulty. And you give away what you most want, or you offer out relief. And I think it's very interesting when you start to examine Tonglen for yourself, you might notice you do one of these more than another. In fact, that's just occurred to me for the first time this week. I never noticed it. I never actually think about sharing what I'm happy about. It never occurs to me. Like, if it's a beautiful day, think of all other people that, you know, may they be happy as well, or appreciate the cardinal sitting up in the sky on the tree that lives in my yard and sings all the time. So it's that sense of being willing to share and open your joy, as well as to bring in whatever is painful or difficult. So to me, the Tonglen practice is really the central practice within Lojong. And it really encompasses the whole path of Lojong, really, within there. Because when you think about the first stage of the teaching of Tonglen, the first stage is just opening and resting in space. You're just letting go into space. And that's what we call the absolute bodhicitta practice. And it's absolute because there's really nothing to do. It's just about relaxing and opening into space. And then from there, we work with the relative slogans, and we see that we start right away with relative bodhicitta point 7, which is sending and taking, which is Tonglen practice. So Lojong is a very powerful practice, as you might have found as well. And it's also a practice that you do on the cushion as a contemplation, and off the cushion in daily life as situations come up. So you can see how this particular practice is helping us to bring the teachings really through us and out into the world much more fully. It's not just little old me sitting on the cushion imagining or working with my own little thing, but it's really about on the cushion processing and working with difficult situations, and then when I get up and I go about my life, it's about working with situations as I'm engaging them, as well as remembering the slogans. So I think another question is, how does practicing Lojong help us to cultivate compassion? And I'd like to stop here for a moment and just contemplate this and then hear what you might think about that. So the question is, how does practicing Lojong help us cultivate compassion? Because, in fact, that's the title of this module. And we may not have actually talked about that too much.
What the book says, I don't know if it's true, is it seemed like Pema was saying, if you develop compassion for yourself and your own horrible, miserable self, your wretchedness, you can in that way have compassion for others, because you realize that others are just as rotten as you are.
Well said, well said. I think that's a really central point, having compassion for yourself. And we'll hear anyone else. Thoughts on compassion?
I mean, kind of related to the bodhicitta ideas, your own, the self-compassion piece is sort of realizing your own basic goodness. And if you have basic goodness, even though you stink, then everybody else does too, including everyone who's awful. So it's this sort of underlying basic goodness in the universe. So of course you'd be compassionate.
Mm-hmm. It's like calisthenics for the mind.
Yeah.
You know, like it, by offering up these different slogans, it actually engages the mind to open up in ways that sometimes were unexpected, because it invites a certain amount of self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, one is invited into a confrontation of self.
It sort of it sheds light on all our dark corners. That's how I feel. It's like, I don't really want to know that, you know. Don't try to be the fastest. I always want to be the fastest. So it's sort of like, oh no, wait. It's just you see all your, you know, all the ways. Because the slogans, they're so uncompromising, aren't they? It's like, and they get at what we all do. And I think for me, it's like realizing when we understand our own prejudice, when we understand our own anger, when we feel our own hurt, then we can understand why there's war. Well, I think Pema even says this, why there's war, rape, murder, embezzlement. You know, you can imagine all the things that arise from those same feelings that other people work with and struggle with. So I think compassion just develops naturally from really working on ourselves. So that's why it's not, I'm better than that person and I will help them and make them feel better. But we're all in the same boat and we can have more compassion because we see we see the failings in ourselves, so we can actually relate to everything that's going on around us.
I would say that, just to kind of go along with that, I view compassion as just connection, and I think with the teachings where it's just so weird to give away the good things that we have and to take in the bad things that we experience. That's just not, that's not something that I'm used to doing. And I think that by not doing that, you create separation, you don't create connection, and then if you flip it around, if you give away the good things that you're experiencing and you take in the bad, then you just automatically have more compassion because you have more understanding of other people. And like you're saying, like if you understand your own anger or your own negative emotions, then you can you can understand it in someone else, and that just creates a connection, no longer a separation.
Mm-hmm. And as Bevan said, we also see the goodness in ourselves, and therefore can see that in others too.
Right.
It's not about being wretched, just.
That's true.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd tell you a little story. This is a story time here. I had the good fortune, or you could say a lot of it was struggle, but it looks good in retrospect, of doing a long retreat at Gampo Abbey. Actually, it was a 3-year retreat broken up in between by a year because we alternated. There were two groups that went through together, and 1 year one group was in and the other year out, and we switched back and forth. So Gampo Abbey is in Nova Scotia, you may have heard, and it literally is at the end of the road. The road is first a regular highway, then Nova Scotia is an island, basically, and Cape Breton. This is way at the end of Cape Breton, and it's on there's cliffs overlooking the St. Lawrence Bay, so it's extremely dramatic. But literally the road turns to pothole tar and then dirt, and at the end is Gampo Abbey. And that's where Pema Chodron lived for quite some time. She doesn't live there now, but she comes to, she goes back there every year. And there's a period called Yarne, and it takes place in the winter, which is a retreat, and Gampo Abbey is closed off at that time. So she's there during that time. So my retreat actually started in September or October, September or before that. So in the second year of our retreat, started, I think that was September, yeah. We were having a lot of difficulty with this retreat leader that actually ran our retreat. So when you're in retreat, you're very isolated, you're separated from the abbey, there's a fence around it, you can't go anywhere, you can't leave, you just follow the rules, and there's nothing to read, there's no music, there's no cell phone, there's no communication except by mail, which is extremely slow to Nova Scotia, more than you could imagine. And you barely can get a pencil if you want one. So it's not so easy. So that fall, we were having some difficulty the first year with the retreat leader. And you can imagine how important that person is. They're your outside link. And she was really, there was a lot of favoritism going on, and, she didn't share some of the material with everyone unless they agreed to meet with her, and some people didn't really want to meet with her anymore. It was difficult. So we're going into the retreat that way, and this middle section of the retreat is the most intense. So actually there's a period of 4 months of total silence. You cannot speak at all. You can write notes. So we were having a lot of turmoil right before the retreat and wanting to have a shift in management, you could say. But we were going into silence, so there was nothing really we could do about it too much. But as the retreat went on, a month or so, things just got worse, and the notes, you can only write so much in the note, but still, you can imagine how much you were thinking about it. And then after a couple months, it really was bad. And so Pema actually came back to retreat. She came into she came back to Gampo Abbey for this Yarné retreat. So they called her in. They said, "You really have to go meet with these retreatants because things are not going well over there." So they gave us dispensation to be able to talk, and we got to meet with Pema. So we sort of laid out our complaints, and she listened. And you can imagine the message, which was she did not take sides. She wouldn't solve the problem, and she wanted us to look at the storyline and really, you know, look at the story and drop the storyline and feel the emotion. Well, at one of the meetings, I was so mad, I left, and I went downstairs on the porch, and I'll never forget this. I was on the floor. I was down on the ground floor, and the meeting was upstairs in the shrine room. And I stood on the porch, and I was so mad. I felt like I was going to explode. I couldn't go anywhere. Pema wasn't going to fix it. She wouldn't agree with me, and I was one of the ringleaders in trying to get rid of this person. And I knew I was right, and it was just the most impossible situation. There was actually no solution. So she kept saying, "Drop the storyline," and it was really impossible. And I did remember that there was such a thing as Lojong, but I literally never applied one slogan. So, be grateful to everyone. You know, in retrospect, I'd have to say that would have been really good. This person was just wanting to be loved, and she was trying to get favorites and be more loved. So she was looking for love, and she was trying to be generous in her own way. And she had a soft spot, and I could have seen her potential bodhicitta, but I certainly didn't. Don't bring things to a painful point. Whoa. Down on that, definitely I was determined to win. Don't wait in ambush. Well, we were all doing that until we got a chance and trying to get Pema to give us a solution. Abandon all hope of fruition. So I thought I'd read to you, Pema, here. Abandon all hope of fruition. It's on 103. Okay, here we go. The basic ground of compassionate action is the importance of working with rather than struggling against. And what I mean by that is working with your own unwanted, unacceptable stuff, so that when the unacceptable and unwanted appears out there, you relate to it based on having worked with loving kindness for yourself. Then there is no condescension. This non-dualistic approach is true to the heart because it's based on our kinship with each other. We know what to say because we have experienced closing down, shutting off, being angry, hurt, rebellious, and so forth, and have made a relationship with those things in ourselves. This is not about problem resolution. Bingo. This is a more open-ended and courageous approach. It has to do with not knowing what will happen. It has nothing to do with wanting to get ground under your feet. It's about keeping your heart and your mind open to whatever arises without hope or fruition. Problem solving is based first on thinking there is a problem, and second on thinking there is a solution. Well, that's obvious. Come on. The concepts of problem and solution can keep us stuck in thinking that there is an enemy and a saint, or a right way and a wrong way. The approach we're suggesting is more groundless than that. And groundless, I guess, is where we don't really want to be. And it's very painful to be groundless. And in fact, she never gave us an answer, I have to say. But eventually we actually didn't have a retreat master, and I'm not sure that that was the best thing either. We had to go through the cook. So, you know, that was the only person that came in was the cook. So things changed, but It was very difficult. And I think that's the thing about being in some situations that you really can't, you know, they don't come out the way you want them to come out. But you work with the stuck place, whatever it is, and try to find a resolution that maybe goes beyond, you know, the solution you think should happen. So so that's my story about my own forgetting Tonglen and forgetting Lojong, because it's all about solidification, and I was very good at that. Maybe I still am. So I'd like to actually move on and talk about some of these slogans at the end. Point six is disciplines of mind training, and point seven is guidelines of mind training. So we have time now to, you know, if you have thought, there was homework, if you are aware of it, good. If not, that's okay. And I think Michael put that on the website. If you could come and think about some slogan that you might want to discuss, either that you don't understand or you understand and want to talk about or share your knowledge about it, or any slogans that puzzle you, or that you just work, maybe there are certain ones that you really work with a lot and they mean a lot to you. So whatever you wish to share is great.
Being grateful for everyone is easier after there's a little space. When you get a little distance from the heat of the experience, mm-hmm. and then you can look back and, oh, okay, I can see the painting in a bigger way. Mm-hmm. I'm not so close to it. But at the time, it feels like, how can I be grateful for this?
Yeah. Right, because you're feeling the first reaction,
yeah,
the usual
the protective
pull back.
Of it.
Yeah.
So that one comes up a lot for me, because mm-hmm. I try to reflect as time goes on, mm-hmm. and there usually is some gratefulness in there for even some of the really bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And practice can bring it faster. Or even on the spot.
Yes, that would be nice.
We keep working on it.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the same one.
Yeah.
That comes up for me a lot. There's something about more of the teaching that you can learn something from everybody. And I volunteer on the suicide hotline. And I hear a lot of difficult stories. And I swear I learn things from every single person.
Mm.
It's just amazing to me, as sort of off kilter and going in, you know, very solid directions all the time that they are, a lot of people. There's always something that really resonates and I carry with me after the shift. And it's very humbling to, I guess, because people have such, you know, it's the deep feeling. Sometimes they have the same feelings everyone else is experiencing, or they have it more deeply.
Mm-hmm.
It's more unsettling for them. And so you can really just put a lot of things in perspective. So. Maybe that's an easy one for me. I should
work on the harder ones.
Yeah.
What's a harder one? Oh, no, it's the same slogan.
That's okay. Maybe she has another one.
The thing that was the hardest was when the Tonglen thing about the bringing in the pain. that.
Yeah.
Nothing has unsettled me like that. But I feel a lot better about that.
I'd like to mention number 27, because I always avoid something like this.
Read it.
You want to read it?
So. Work with the greatest defilements.
First.
First, yeah. Well, that would be not the first thing I'd do. And a lot of us, including me, are taught that don't start with the biggest, start with the smallest step. And we might have even encountered some encouragement like that in terms of meditation practice. But so that's what this seems like, a repeat of that. But I know with the biggest threats to me, I'm not even aware of them. I think I have my head in the sand. And so I can't even identify a lot of these. But the ones that the greatest apparent defilements or problems or shortcomings or whatever, they're just too threatening. So I just put them to the side, and I at least try to do something small and simple. But, work with the greatest defilements first seems to be the most threatening thing to me. And I think it's something like it's sort of a twist on number 54, which is train wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's like do it without reservation. You know, it's to let go. To me, these are variations of to let go is to be open to the groundless,
mm-hmm.
and it's the most right. And why stop?
Well, think of the title of the book, you know? What's the title of her book here?
No Escape.
Well, there is no escape. Now that you keep showing up, there's no escape. Let's face that. But start where you are. So it's very interesting. So start where you are is... You know, you're saying, well, wait, I don't know if I can handle the greatest defilements. I can't really, maybe I can't take on the biggest. So that's okay. Look at the title of the book, Start Where You Are. So the point here is wherever there's an entry for us, you know, if we can, you know, you pick something here to work on that you can, that's an entry point for you. The reason I think, you know, we talk about work with the greatest defilements first, those are kind of what you notice as your biggest obstacle or your usual route of, your biggest track that you're always going down. So it, for some people it might be anger, for other people it's, you know, other thing, you know, whatever it is. That's, I think it's referring to look at the biggest obstacles. But, you know, again, you've got the other side of it, which is start where you are. And I'm sure there's slogans in here for everyone that resonate for them and maybe are possible to work with.
Also, if you're just really working with where you are, then it's not like you have to go somewhere other than where you are. It's not like, oh my God, I got to take care of this huge monster out in the garage. When actually, I got plenty of work with in the living room or the kitchen. But I mean, if you're really, the point of it is, on some level too, is recognizing when we start this, is we're doing two things. We're learning how to give up our self-cherishing. And these slogans are meant to chip away. Any one of those slogans alone is not necessarily going to do it. It's like that's why we have these multifaceted situations, ways of finding just momentary little chips. We're not going to take our sledgehammer out and knock the whole thing over. That's not going to happen. It's more like individual circumstances, which we can't foresee. And oftentimes what we really anticipate or think about are really no big deal at all when we get there. It's these other things that we just are so completely shut down about, because we couldn't even expect them. So you're just going to be where you are with that situation. And I think that's really the whole key to that mm-hmm. title, is that's the only place to start.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, let me hear from
somebody. Do all Buddhist traditions have the same Lojong text?
No.
No. No. So...
So there are variations on these.
They don't all, not all the Buddhist traditions use these.
Use this.
Right.
This is a rather Tibetan thing, okay?
Okay.
Different Buddhist traditions have different what are called skillful means of working on, all dharmas agree on one point, which is reducing our absorption on self, right? Seeing, mm-hmm. seeing for self. Mm-hmm. So Zen has a different skillful means, and Theravadins have different skillful means, and it depends on the school and how well the teacher can present an authentic tradition without giving up on it and taking the easy route, which not all teachers can do. But this is a, whatever you do, you're going to have to do it particularly.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you and I have to do it as English-speaking people. Mm-hmm. We can't choose
right.
to be Tibetans
right. yeah.
or Japanese or anyone else or
yeah.
Europeans. We have to be who we are. And we have to teach within our tradition, because we know that, and we haven't had training in other traditions. Or we've had a little bit of it, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
I find about this path is that there's a certain amount of clarity or discernment that kind of sneaks up on you. And in particular, I mean, I'm seeing connections between different slogans. And this slogan, don't misinterpret, it's pretty interesting, because it also ties into don't act with a twist, to me, anyway, with me in my journey. And so this idea of, you know, being able to be present and to breathe through difficulty, and to keep, you know, the open heart, the compassionate heart, but at the same time, what I appreciate, but also what I struggle with, is there's compassion and then there's idiot compassion
right.
idea, and to when just to, you know, say stop it, and then, you know, it go on instead of like, yes, I would. I understand your pain, you know, and it's, and then it's like, well, maybe that's really, bottom line, that's acting with a twist. So that it's kind of like this,
yeah.
you know,
right.
this spiral
right.
of like uncovering, well, it's, all right, there it is, a new one to unearth within oneself. And I don't, I don't know where this is going with the don't misinterpret, other than the fact that it is something that I personally struggle with.
Can I say something, because I'd had that discussion with you privately.
Yeah.
And I don't think people here have heard that term, idiot compassion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that, so I'd just like to bring it out. Is that okay?
Okay.
So Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talked sometimes about idiot compassion as a foolish thing, and what he meant was to try to express compassion by always trying to be nice and go along with someone no matter what the situation is. And there are times when the compassionate thing to do to someone is to go, that may not be easy. You could act with a twist. You could misinterpret it. But when you're right, that is the right thing to do, is to not go along with someone misusing themselves and coming up with continuous excuses, not allowing someone to continue to be self-deceptive.
Or to harm you.
What?
It's also or to harm you.
Well, now that's self-protection. That's another point. Yes. You.
But it's also
but that's not
trying to make yourself comfortable in a potentially uncomfortable cut, to really be direct. And it is a way of also going against perhaps your desire for being comfortable. You want the situation to be nice and smoothed over. So, you know, I'm just willing to be sympathetic regardless of whether you're pointing a gun to your head to blow your brains out because, oh, I understand completely.
That's like, isn't that idiot convention?
Yeah. I'm just saying.
That's what I was just saying.
So, this is where the idea of self-cherishing comes in. Actually, another thing Rinpoche said was compassion is not being polite to ego. So this gives you a more of another aspect of compassion, as Michael just brought up, which sometimes can be called wrathful. It's not always just being nice and sweet and accommodating and, you know, making everybody comfortable. It can sometimes be making people feel very uncomfortable, not because it's calculated, but because it's just a natural response. Mm-hmm. So we're really talking on some level about really an innate responsiveness to the situation, a way to respond to the fundamental situation at hand. And compassionate action is just completely without any reference point to self. It's completely beyond self. So it's beyond my personal opinion or yours, or it's just there, and it's so clear that it can be very painful. It's not necessarily an easy situation at all.
Michael finish, because he didn't get... Did you finish what you wanted to say?
I think you've said a fair amount of it. Yes, that's correct. But to get back to you, you were concerned that in order to be able to act without idiot compassion, in order to be direct, you have to know that you're not misinterpreting also. Isn't that what you were saying?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're not acting with a twist. That is, there's no devious motion within yourself. Is that what you were expressing?
Yes, I believe so, yeah. I think this idea of no self, or the fact that there's your truth, there's my truth, then there's the truth. It's kind of that sensibility in terms of the clarity of, like, it just is. And just to be able to say it, or witness it at least, can be disquieting.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not always comfortable.
Yeah.
No. But that takes courage. And that's, you know, I think we have to be able to step up to that. You know, when there's more clarity, then you can act with more certainty, I think, and more confidence. So it is actually developing confidence, because we can see things more clearly. And then because you can see, that's prajna, that sense of then knowing what the proper action is. It's not so cloudy and confused. I think about, you know, raising children. You have a young child, I know, and I just think, you know, like, sometimes when you work with a 2-year-old, you know, you don't go through some logic, you know, you just deal with them in a very direct way. And it's confusing if you try to, you know, mush it around. You can't really mush around. You've got to be very direct. So I think there's situations like that, you know, you just have some sense of clarity and a direct action. Yeah, Ed.
Yeah, I like the slogans, and, you know, I also like the titles of the book. If you don't know where you're going, you know, you'll never get lost. Start where you are.
What book is that? I don't know. I don't think we assigned that. Are you writing that book? Is that why you didn't come last week? Because we're lost?
No, just kidding.
Vast knowledge of confusion. You know, when I try and tailor them so that they mean something.
Uh-huh.
I'm not dyslexic, but when I look at this, I prostrate to the great compassionate one. Well, I read that and it says, you know, I procrastinate to the great. And I'll eventually get there.
Okay. You know,
I listen and I try and understand and I get confusion, but I know a lot of confusion comes.
Wisdom.
Wisdom.
Wisdom. Yes.
What's marvelous is that we torture you and you keep coming back.
Yeah.
That's what I was going
to
say.
Yeah, you're wondering why you're here.
This is so depressing. Because it really does show how wretched, you know, I am. And it's like, you know, and then it came up like we were supposed to also see the good in ourselves. Oh, I forgot about that. I thought we were supposed to, but then we're, you know, I'm having a hard time holding on to that when we're continually chipping away at ourselves. I mean, we're chipping away at ourselves, cherishing, mm-hmm. but it's hard to not see it as I'm just a bunch of shit, you know. And it's hard to...
Remember, we were going to... We didn't start with this without grounding ourselves in meditation practice and using a discerning mind to... recognize we're not believing our thoughts. So when your thoughts start taking over, it's almost like ego thinks it can do a better job than what the Buddha said. I'm going to go in and call you, you know, I'm just a piece of shit, and this way I know I'll be more effective. Well, that you actually understand, and you understand that the quality, you just experience the texture and the context and the whole thing. You realize that's not effective at all. That's what's like parents beating their kids up with, you know, a hammer and thinking they're going to shut up and making them feel bad. That's not the answer to raising good children. So we're trying to develop ourselves, raise our own quality of life. And it is kind. We have to be kind to ourselves, merciful to ourselves. So when you hear those thoughts, that's the pattern that you recognize, oh, it's the old part of my ego trap. It's just going on like an old broken record, you know. I'm a piece of shit, you know.
This really feeds into it.
So why does it feed into it? I want to hear why you feel that way.
It reveals all the things that we do that, you know, are really not very nice.
But why does that add up to piece of shit? You know, I mean, these are just human foibles. This
is depressing. This is a depressing place to be. I guess it feels like to me.
But this is how we liberate ourselves.
I
think the premise is that there's this like underlying basis that if we chip away at all the shit that we've calcified, built up over our years of not being babies anymore. Because when you start as a little baby, the baby's not a baby's not a little piece of shit. And we were all babies at the same time. So it's like that core goodness is still there.
I'm having trouble finding that.
So, but that's a concept too. So you're,
I don't necessarily have to find it. I think it's just you already have it.
You know it's there. It's part of the knowing that it's there.
Yeah. I guess I think maybe I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Think about the gap. When we're in the gap, we're giving up, trying to figure it out, trying to put the genie in a bottle. We're just there. We're just here. This is the only place we need to be.
In the mindful gap.
If you're just willing to just be here
and
completely open yourself up to right now, here, as you are, and just let go and relax, which is part of the only way we're actually going to discover fundamental goodness, is if we have to relax and accept that where we are is enough. It's just that.
Don't other people get into a point where meditation just isn't any fun anymore? I mean, it's just...
Sure.
This is lousy. I don't like doing this. I wish it would end. I want to leave the room.
Okay, well, let's hear. Yeah, look, you're getting nods.
When you...
Okay.
I know, but other people seem like they just, it's not a problem.
Wait, you don't know what's happening.
I'm not hearing
Let's
that.
Hear what's happening in somebody's mind.
I try, whenever I wake up every morning, I try and sit. And there's clearly differences every single morning. There's mornings where I look at my watch every 5 minutes and I have to move. This is awful. Like, I can't, I'm just resisting everything. It's like, yesterday I had an awesome meditation, so why can't I look at meditation now? and that's just resisting to the fact that my thoughts are just going to happen. And again, I'll have a good meditation one morning, and I'll have a one where I'm totally lost in thought on the other, but it just happens.
The other thing is, I mean, those thoughts are the opportunity to have the mindful gap. So it's not like it's, you know, we're trying to eradicate those. It's, they're giving us the opportunity, and that's what I try and focus on, because I'm not a big, I don't like blind faith, but I think you guys had said the path is the goal one time, and that really resonated with me. So it's not like I'm trying to get rid of these thoughts.
The thought is the path. It's like,
exactly.
Every single time you have a thought, it's like, oh, this is an opportunity for me right now to be present with it.
Yeah, and for me, what I struggle with, Roberta, I mean, just on the same level too, is it's physically, it hurts me to be in that position with, you know, the erect spine and stuff, and even that physical sensation is an opportunity to not buy into that, to shift my focus, obviously not to the point where I'm trembling, but, you know.
You know, it's just like with the low jaw, the path is, you know, sort of really sucked, certainly. So
I've been working with this. I'm with you. It's made it harder to sit. It's made me squirrely on and off the cushion. It's a fearsome kind of thing, I think. And every once in a while, I feel like, oh, there's more room in my heart than I thought there was.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time like just going, okay, just now go back to the shamatha. That doesn't seem like it.
You mean from the Tonglin practice?
From the Tonglin, yeah. It seems like I get stuck there. So I think I just have to do the gap.
I can't do Tonglin breaths for a real consistent time. I've got to let a few of those, it's hard, so then I can go to shamatha. So I didn't follow your, okay, now all this time is Tonglin. I find it really, it's hard. Sometimes I go out of the and then go back to it. But I also think that the Tonglin, that when breathing out, it's helping. It helps to open up your heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, that seems to be the most, a very effective way of finding, of connecting with that inner good part in you, in that's in all of us. And I also think that working with the slogans is, I work with people, and I have family and friends and a husband. They all do things like this, so we all do this. You're not alone. What makes you think you're the only person who does all of this?
Not hearing anyone else, so it's
so
good to
just
hear.
You're not
that's
alone.
I mean, that's good to hear that other
you're,
people.
You're not, but
yeah.
that...
Yeah.
It's having compassion for the human condition, and they're human.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's right on, and I felt like Emily said it right in the beginning, where, you know, 1,000 years ago, people were having
the
same struggles,
right.
So
yeah.
That's the compassion.
And I think knowing that it is the human condition, it kind of just inspires you to try to be a better friend to yourself.
Right.
You know, because this is how our mind operates. It's how the ego is. It's critical. And to be gentle with that, but also kind of turn it around and say, you know, I'm going to be good to myself.
Yeah, this is, I have to do, this is so huge.
It's big.
You know, that's, I think, sort of what happened, because in the beginning, the Tonglin did feel helpful. I could, you know, ease up into something, and then as I went on, it was like, oh my God. So, but I also stopped the Tonglin way before, you know, the bills.
Mm-hmm. It's OK. Okay? You do it at your own pace. You do it. You do what works, you know. If you're willing to try it and to do it, do a little bit and see. I find, you know, it's not a practice I've really, you know, jumped on. But now that we're doing it in class, Michael and I do it every morning in the middle of our practice. And I find the repetition of doing it every day, the familiarity, I start to remember it more overall, and even during the day I might remember it more. It's definitely bringing it into your life on a daily basis, it starts to be more familiar. And then, like anything, I mean, I think it makes it a little easier. I mean, at least I think I'm there somewhat. Where in the old days, when I used to do Tonglen, I literally had a technique where we had to do it for half an hour during the middle of a practice that we were supposed to do. And I could sit on my cushion and fall asleep exactly. And I would wake up exactly a half an hour later. And I would write it down that I did Tonglen. I was asleep the entire time. And I can't really sleep sitting up, but I did. I don't know. So I hated it so much. I never did Tonglen. Yeah, and, you know, I've never given up, you know. I mean, well, maybe someday I'll be able to do it. But I mean, it's not easy.
I think the idea is that, I mean, when she was mentioning that one of the, some, like when we did Nundro. These half-hour segments, that was
right,
what the
half an hour was a requirement.
So what you would do is really, before you get there, you do these little snippets, and even though we took 5 minutes today, I think it was 5 minutes.
That's all it was?
5 minutes.
Are you kidding?
Yes.
I don't think you noticed. It was longer
was
than that.
It.
No.
I guess it was pretty good.
Well, good is a relative term.
Know, if you can do 2 minutes of it, that's fine. Just do it for a couple of, really give it, and then when you realize I'm hitting a wall, stop.
Yeah.
It's like we're not supposed to be, you know, torturing ourselves with this. And then you can go back later. You could flash on it again. I mean, the main thing is you flash on bodhicitta.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah.
You can go back to that
when
you start getting wearied out. You go, bing, you know. Suddenly, I'm here, you know, like, whoa, you know. And that's a form of refreshment. And then you can just go back even and just go through, if you want, the absolute slogans, which are reminders, and they're actually a kind of mini empowerment. Mm-hmm. If we just really are willing to contemplate and place ourselves in those spaces of those contemplations, we're actually going to gain some kind of an insight about fundamental no ego. And that's not a problem. It's not like, oh, no ego. It's more just about space, open space. So, you know, we can refresh. And that's part of Tonglen. It's not like, well, I spent 2 minutes huffing and puffing, and then I went back to, you know, relaxing into space. It's okay.
All right, thank you, everybody.
So we're at the end of our time, pretty much. If anyone has a comment that didn't get to say something, would like to say something, you're welcome to.
Yes. I have a leftover thought.
Okay.
When I'm practicing, and you know, I look for the calm abiding, and I look for the mindful gap, and I try and not be aware that it's coming, because then I'm anticipating it. But I find that, you know, my thoughts become insidious. They're lying in wait just for, you know, a chance to, you know, to jump in and say, ah, you know, I didn't make it.
Oh, you're waiting in ambush.
They're waiting in ambush. You can do it to yourself.
And you know, I have found that I have been missing some time, like you mentioned, say, wow, where was I for that point in time?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know whether it's when I was asleep or when I was levitating. I just feel good that I said, wow, I don't know what time it is. I must have done something right. But I can't give myself any credit because I don't remember.
So were you present or were you gone?
No, I can't tell you. But I wasn't aware.
And
I think that's good.
Well, I think the point is to be aware. That's the point of practice, and to be present. So if you're completely gone and spaced out, kind of drifted somewhere else, then you're actually lost somewhere in thought or lost in whatever. But the point of the practice is actually to come back and to be present. And it's not to try to get rid of thinking, but when you notice you're thinking, to return, just to return, come back. There you go. That's good. All it takes is willingness, really. I mean, we have to start with willingness. So I just want to mention, again, next week is a movie, so we're going to do that early on, right after 7:05. And then the following week, I think it'll be the following week, we're going to start with a new book. We already mentioned that. And, Michael, are you going to try to get some?
Yes, for something? Okay, this book we're going to get is called What Makes You Not a Buddhist. It's by Dzongsa Kenpo Rinpoche. I think it's around $14. I'll make a note. We can post it on the...
okay, we'll make a book.
But if you're interested
on the
in having me order the book for you, I will. I'll bring it in and, you know, we'll take care of it. In other words, I'll just take care of the whole thing. But I need to know the numbers.
Do you want them now?
You can tell me now if you want, sure.
Yeah, okay.
If you want Michael to get you the book, you want to raise your hand?
Let's see. Can you get it on Amazon?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon.
You can get it on you can download it, you can get it in the local bookstore.
You can put it on Kindle, probably, yeah.
Yeah, you can put it on Kindle.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so so that's fine.
Yeah, I'd like if you can order it.
Oh. Well, listen.
Okay.
Are you the only one?
So far.
It's in the library.
Yeah,
it might be.
Yeah, you can let me know next week. I need about a 3-day lead time. Okay. So if you don't think you know now, and maybe next week you want, that's fine. I'll probably get a few extra copies anyway for people who change their mind.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so I think we're done. No, well.